Up North News with Pat Kreitlow is a product of Courier Newsroom and has a joint sales agreement with Civic Media. Enjoy.
Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. You're listening to Up North News.
This is, I hear you knocking. This is good for the search warrant at Mar-a-Lago. Unfortunately, you know, one song isn't going to cut it. They do get to come in after a knock. They get to seize a lot of records that Donald Trump was not supposed to have at Mar-a-Lago. Welcome back to Up North News. I'm Pat Kreitlow. It is a Monday morning. Brewers lost 2 of 3 against the Cardinals and now have a 4-game series at home against the LA Dodgers starting tonight. Maybe not everybody knows that I ran for Congress in 2012 and lost to Sean Duffy. And ever since that time, when the now former congressman, you know, appears on my screen for something that he said, I usually keep teed up a classic Saturday Night Live line from John Lovitz from 1988, when he was portraying Michael Dukakis and Dana Carvey was portraying George H.W. Bush. And after George H.W. Bush's character goes on and on about 1,000 points of light, the debate turns back to John Lovitz as Michael Dukakis. And he just looks at the camera and says, "I can't believe I'm losing to this guy." And that's something I keep queued up a lot and had to pull it out again this weekend when the former Congressman Sean Duffy was on Fox News. And his point about, about Donald Trump, do you actually have that, Luke?
I'm pretty speedy, Pat. So yeah, I got it.
Well, look at that. Okay. Well, let's listen to what the former member of Congress had to say about why, Donald Trump didn't do anything wrong bringing boxes of classified documents to Mar-a-Lago.
That you believe that justice is blind. No right. matter when there's a violation of the law, when anyone is attacked, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, I stand up and say that's inappropriate. But when you exclude the justices of the court, but defend the DOJ, then we go, okay, no, there are two standards of justice. You can attack the Supreme Court justices. You can protest outside their homes, but don't say anything about the Department of Justice. Can I make one other point, Martha? I think it's interesting. Do you ever think that Donald Trump was packing boxes out of the White House to move them to Mar-a-Lago? Do you think that he went through the boxes in Mar-a-Lago? Do you think he knows what he had in those boxes? I don't think he did. And so to come after Donald Trump criminally, I think it's going to be very challenging for the Department of Justice, because I don't think he packed them. I don't think he knew what was in them. There was a negotiation about those boxes, but Donald Trump didn't look through them. Donald Trump didn't pack them. And so criminally, I don't think there's going to be any liability here, or very challenging for the Department of Justice, unless he had top secret information in his desk drawer at Mar-a-Lago and they found that, maybe, but more than likely it's in boxes down in some locker room in Mar-a-Lago and it'll go nowhere.
They better have a lot, as I've been saying, because otherwise they've undercut their own credibility, and they've also probably helped the former president to galvanize even more support based on all of this. So I want to ask you about this as well. Another big.
All right. This is where, again, you come out of a bite like that, and it's just, it's a three. You wish you always had handy the meme of, is it Nathan Fillion, the actor? Just, he doesn't know what to say. He just, with his fingers and his jaws open, and just, there's just nothing comes out because you don't know what to say after something like that. Donald Trump did not personally pack the boxes, so he couldn't have known what was in the boxes. So Sean Duffy is doing one of two things. He's either calling Trump dumb because he somehow lets, other people take away boxes of classified documents and just put them in his house without him knowing, or the former congressman is telling on himself. Because essentially he's saying, who reads all that important stuff? Am I right? I mean, come on. I didn't read any of those things. I had people for that.
He's a busy man. He's not expected to read all of what's in the boxes that he took out of the White House to Mar-a-Lago. Come on.
No, those logs aren't going to roll themselves, And then to say that the only way Trump would be guilty is if he had top secret info in his desk drawer. And then he says, maybe if he had classified, you would think a member of Congress would not only know about the levels of classified information, why it's classified, what makes it important, and then again, would have enough respect and reverence for the men and women in our intelligence community and otherwise in service to the government, that you don't treat these things like cocktail napkins, you know, and that you can just throw them in a box and say, well, you know, I'll go through these later. That is not what this is at all. And again, we still don't know. And also, by the way, we're not supposed to know. There's, you know, there's like nuclear secrets and things in there. And so if Trump wants to be cavalier about this, and some of his allies have said, well, he declassifies, you know, things, and, you know, because presidents can do that, they can deem something declassified. Well, if you can deem it declassified, it also means, you know, you or I could do a public records, you know, freedom of information request, and we could see the contents of this. So we need to stop tolerating people making excuses for what appears to be something so egregious of taking documents, and apparently taking documents just from meetings, because who's going to say no to the president of the United States when he says, hey, can I take this? And he takes it back to the residence. You know, documents that are only supposed to be seen in the most secure locations. And now, I grant you, everything after this is speculative, but Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, you know, that $2 billion that his equity fund got from the Saudis, again, we still don't know that it was out of the goodness of their heart. We don't know what was in those documents. And so let's not jump to conclusions, but let's not make excuses either until we find out what it is that should not have been taken to Florida. We'll be back after this. You're up north. Oh boy. So now it comes out from WISN TV in Milwaukee, Channel 12. Ron Johnson was asked about these sensitive national security documents that Trump, or maybe it wasn't Trump because he doesn't really know what's in the boxes, but you know, somebody put them in there. They were in Mar-a-Lago. Senator Ron Johnson got asked by Channel 12 about, you know, whether he is concerned with the sensitive information that was found at Mar-a-Lago. Please bear in mind that Senator Ron Johnson is the now former chair of the Homeland Security Committee for the United States Senate. So if anybody should have concerns, it would be the former chair of the U.S. Senate's Homeland Security Committee. Johnson said, I'm not overly concerned about some top secret information being leaked out, adding that while he is always concerned about classified documents, he thinks that the documents are in the possession of Donald Trump are in a secure location guarded by the Secret Service, that Mar-a-Lago he considers to be a pretty safe place. A pretty safe place. Well, that's what you want with your top secret documents that sometimes can only be looked at in bunkers that are fortified and guarded by people with big weapons. Sure, a couple of Secret Service agents, because Trump has never, you know, abused his Secret Service detail and, you know, sent them someplace where they're not supposed to be. But for Ron Johnson, Mar-a-Lago is a pretty safe place. So I guess that's good enough. This news about Donald Trump and the mishandling of classified documents and the search warrant being executed, yeah, it was a big story. But again, in our continuing reminder to the national news media that you can walk and chew gum at the same time, we need to be reminded that it was also a big week in Congress for Democrats who got the Inflation Reduction Act passed. It was something that, you know, started as the Build Back Better package. It has taken a long time for a portion of that to come through Congress, but it did. And as we've outlined previously, it is landmark legislation in so many ways. It will have such a direct positive impact on American taxpayers, American workers, American healthcare consumers, and on the planet, and on our tax system, and more. It was a big deal. And yet, Andrea Mitchell was guest hosting Meet the Press over the weekend and said that the Mar-a-Lago investigation had basically wiped the Democrats' historic week from the headlines. And she was rightly jumped on by media critics and others who said, who has the power to do that? Who has the power to say, you know, what's in the headlines? I don't know. Maybe people like you, Andrea, in the media, who instead began with Trump on Meet the Press. Trump was in the middle. Trump was in the end. And then she says, oh, all this Trump stuff really wiped, you know, the Democrats from the headlines. About as complicit as an admission as possible that she, Miss Butter Emails, you know, has a thing about keeping Donald Trump in the headlines. And again, that's not necessarily partisan, but as we talked about last week with Michael Wagner and with others, it's that there is this insatiable need to have content that attracts eyeballs and, you know, promotes engagement. And this is fine, again, if we're talking about Kylie Jenner and Travis Scott and what they're going to name their baby. But when it comes to national security issues, when it comes to the integrity of our elections, we really should have a higher bar and not just put, you know, Donald Trump on there because, you know, people find that interesting. That's what gave us Donald Trump as a national security risk for all these years, and has led to this culture of feeling like, well, since he's always getting the attention, that he must always be, you know, above the law, and that everything they do must be above the law. And, you know, as Trump and others are finding out, the law does eventually catch up to you in many cases. Sadly, not all, but in many cases. That's what's being learned by South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who learned from a federal judge today that he will, in fact, have to testify into investigations about how he and Trump and others tried to influence, if not, overtly and fraudulently interfere with the 2020 election results in Georgia. You may recall that infamous phone call that Trump made to Georgia's Secretary of State, trying to get him to find, you know, a certain number of votes, and that way Trump would get Georgia's electoral votes. Well, Lindsey Graham had made some phone calls down to Georgia as well, and so he has been asked to testify as part of an investigation into all of this. And Graham had said that he should be exempt from testifying because of, you know, speech protections or debate clause protections or sovereign immunity or his, high ranking government position. And in all cases, a U.S. district judge has now just rejected all of those arguments and found that the district attorney in Georgia has shown extraordinary circumstances exist and that there is a very need for Senator Lindsey Graham to testify on whether there were any attempts to influence or disrupt the lawful administration of Georgia's 2022 election. This all began with a grand jury investigation a couple of months back. That grand jury investigation so far has identified more than 100 people of interest. There has already been testimony given by Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, and his staff. And Graham is of interest to the committee, writes the Washington Post, because of phone calls that he made to Raffensperger about Georgia's election system. It's been claimed that he requested that certain absentee ballots be reexamined to explore the possibility of a more favorable outcome. Again, you can't do that. That is as directly trying to influence illegally the administration and outcome of an election as it gets. And, I'm not surprised that Lindsey Graham tried to claim that, you know, he's he's above all this. He's too powerful. He's, you know, too good for it. Because again, you have that culture that says, you know, we can, whatever we've been able to get away with in the past, we can get away with in the future. It's what leads to somebody like Ron Johnson saying, oh, Mar-a-Lago is a pretty safe place for classified information. It is an entire, you know, belief system that, you know, the old rules don't apply to them. And, you know, as a result, you get essentially a willingness to say things that previously, you know, they kind of kept under a rock where they belonged. Not just that, you know, election rules don't apply to them, but, you know, Ron Johnson's getting nailed with a new ad campaign starting today about his comments about Social Security and Medicare. We mentioned this during the first hour of the program that Democrats are running a new digital ad campaign starting today. We posted about it at Up North News. Go to Up North News WI on Facebook, and you can read the post where, you know, Johnson and other Republicans who have put forth certain plans to tinker with Social Security or to you know, threaten it outright, need to answer to that. They need to answer to voters about this. And this is not the, it's no longer the, you know, the Democrats were accused for the longest time of scare tactics, saying, oh, Republicans would never do this. Well, Republicans were never going to overturn, you know, Roe v. Wade either. And let's, you know, look how well that worked out. And you have Ron Johnson now saying directly he would like programs like Social Security and Medicare to be counted as discretionary spending and have to stand for a vote pretty much every year. And so it's led a lot of people to want to make sure that we attack some of the misinformation that's out there about Social Security and Medicare, because people like Ron Johnson want it to look more vulnerable than it is, which is not to say it's ironclad. It requires support. It's a promise from the government. But that doesn't mean we have to lie about it. So I looked for a few different sources, and I'm going to take this one in particular that was written by Devin Carroll of MarketWatch and go after a few of these myths that are out there, so that as you're having these conversations with friends, neighbors in a coffee shop over family dinner or whatnot, and when they talk about, you know, these things, you can say, no, that's not the case. Starting with the number one myth that's raised in this article is about illegal immigrants collecting Social Security, that, you know, Social Security is threatened because, you know, undocumented immigrants are collecting benefits. And if anything, it works the other way around. Social Security is probably more solvent because undocumented immigrants still have payroll deductions quite frequently, which go into Social Security, but they then can't collect the benefits, either because they return to their home country or simply because, again, being undocumented, they can't apply for them. If an individual never obtains work authorization, none of those Social Security covered earnings count toward qualifying for benefits. Those in the words of the Congressional Research Service. Number two is that the government raided the Social Security Trust Fund. That has not been the case. It's a lack of clear explanation about how the trust fund works. And essentially, as your payroll tax deductions go in, it is replaced by treasury notes, treasury bonds rather. And those things are paid back, and they do earn interest. When they changed the way that has always existed that way, but when they changed the way that it was reported, some people claimed it was a raid, and it is not. The accounting is still solid. The money is still there. It's not going bankrupt. However, that takes us to myth number three, that Social Security is going bankrupt. And people believe that because it is a pay-as-you-go system. The money goes in, the money goes right back out to today's retirees. We know about the generational shift that's out there with more and more baby boomers retiring. And so, yeah, if not enough money is coming in, it is possible that the trust fund will start to run dry. And it could happen as early as 2035. You know, so that's 13 years from now. Once that happens, then benefits can only be paid as tax money comes in. And that could be, you know, 75% of benefits. And so, yeah, if you get only 75% of your promised Social Security benefit, it'd be like getting only 75% of your paycheck. You wouldn't like it, but it's not zero. There's a myth that members of Congress don't pay into Social Security. They do, and they have since 1984. So yeah, for, you know, decades prior, they did not. They paid into a separate pension. Many times what's come out is that, yeah, you get back what you put in and then some because of the interest that's generated. So don't let folks like Ron Johnson and others try to scare you. Social Security is there. It is up to us to protect it for ourselves and for future generations of hardworking Americans. We'll be back with more after this. You're up. Isn't this just the perfect time to have Yacht Rock on the radio? I certainly do on my Sirius XM channel. I'm surprised there are more Yacht Rock local radio stations. Maybe that's what we need to do here is after this show and Kristen's show, we just go with the Yacht Rock format.
Hey, that's my hour.
Okay, after your hour, we could do that. Who's going to be the Yacht Rock of the future? What music is being listened to today that will be the stuff that, you know, when is played 30 years from now, you know, their kids are going to go, "Dad, what is this?" You know?
That's an excellent question. That's a hard thing to try to predict, I feel like. You got to really have your finger on the pulse.
Will it be I'm a generation off here, but will it be, you know, the boy bands, you know, the whole Backstreet and all that? Will that be essentially a Yacht Rock genre, you know, years from now that embarrass the kids of the parents who listen to it?
I think that's as good a guess as any. I think that that's probably got to be a leading contender there, but there's no way to know for sure.
Justin Bieber will be the Yacht Rock, you know, of the future. Could be. I really appreciate what one law professor wrote here about the search warrants at Mar-a-Lago. "This wringing of hands over the search warrant is fascinating. I don't get it. If he stole classified documents, he is a criminal. Prosecute him and put him in prison, and then put down any violent insurrection that follows by force, and then move on. Appeasement is not an option." It's that clear. If he stole classified documents, he is a criminal. And anybody that defends that is on the wrong side of the law. Again, if it's correspondence, you know, back and forth to, you know, Kim Jong-il or Putin or whatever, that would be fine. That's not what this is. You know, what was it that you were saying, Luke, about Trump? We know he leaks like a sieve, and he's talking about weapon systems. And again, we don't know what's in this particular batch, but he, Bob Woodward has written about the way that this guy just leaks like a sieve, the national information.
Yeah, apparently when he was meeting with Bob Woodward, again, Woodward got a ton of like off the record access, essentially. He just followed Trump around the White House, and there was an excerpt from his new book that essentially said that Trump told him, "I have built a nuclear weapon system that nobody's ever had in this country before. We have stuff that you haven't even seen or heard about. We have stuff that Putin and Xi have never heard about before. There's nobody. What we have is incredible," is what he told Woodward. And this is just spouting around the White House, just walking about. Like, that's top secret. If it's true, and obviously I think he is one for hyperbole.
I'm going to trust Bob Woodward on this. Yeah.
But Trump is one for hyperbole. So I can understand that, like, maybe he had never heard. The guy didn't know what the nuclear triad was when he first started running for president back in 2015 and 2016. So I'm sure that there's a lot of aspects of what our nuclear capabilities are that Donald Trump just had no clue about and was all new to him. And so there could be some gray area there, but if he's being briefed by the generals that this is like the state-of-the-art stuff that nobody else has got and this is only we have it, and then he's spouting that out to reporters writing a book or on other call, like, it's crazy to think that he's just spouting it out to anybody that would listen.
But he has, and that's in his record. So we know that that's what's happening on his side. Jay Rosen teaches journalism at New York University, and again is one of those people that I really appreciate his press critiques, and he really goes after NPR, National Public Radio, for a story and a tweet that they put up the other day. It said, Republicans and Democrats increasingly think people in the other party are closed-minded, dishonest, unintelligent, and even immoral, according to a large new Pew survey. Now, that sounds fair to you on its face, you know, but the both sides-ism of this is stunning. And as Jay rightly notes, if both parties went off the rails into paranoia, voters in both parties would call the other party a danger to society. But, and this is the key thing, if only one party slid off the rails while the other party remained in the normal range, voters in both parties would still call the other party a danger to society. So the headline from that survey, while it might make sense on its face, is so amazingly misleading. If you don't go a step further, don't just say people on both sides think, you know, the opposite party is closed-minded, dishonest, unintelligent, and even immoral, without stating whether one of the parties is in fact closed-minded, dishonest, unintelligent, and even immoral. If you don't do that, you're simply contributing to that entire, you know, both sides sickness that is plaguing the media today. And that is, you know, where we have found ourselves. It's what led, you know, some of us to want more than just the coffee that's in this mug. That reminds me, you were mentioned walking around the fairgrounds with the Pabst Blue Ribbon the other day because you're classy that way.
Yeah. I mean, I want an award-winning beer when I'm walking around and looking at all the award-winning livestock. That's the best way to take in the fair, in my opinion. So that's what I did on Saturday.
So have you tried the Pabst Blue Ribbon coffee?
I have.
Pabst Blue Ribbon with coffee.
Of course.
And what do we think?
It's delicious. It's a little sweet for me. Mm-hmm. I think there's got to be some kind of like hints of vanilla or something in there. But
there's a caramel flavored one and a regular flavored one.
Okay.
And yeah, I was prepared to hate it. And because they were selling it up at the Mallard, this little resort upriver here. And yeah, it actually was pretty good, which to me sounds pretty dangerous. You know?
Those are my dad has kind of a slogan when we're on vacation. He says you can't be classified as day drinking if you don't start in the morning. And so I feel like PBR's coffee has really assisted in that when I am on vacation. Because you can start really easily in the morning then. Also, when back in June, when I was on vacation, I went down to the Smoky Mountains and I got some of this Appalachian sipping cream. And it is by far one of the best things to put in your coffee in the morning when you are on vacation because it is delicious.
Some of us may need these things come November, depending on the results. And there is apparently some new predictions in from 538, which, you know, again, there's a lot of really smart people that work there, but they're not always right. And, you know, these are just predictions based on various computer models. And they've put out some new ones based on the Wisconsin elections, models that simulate an election 40,000 times to see who wins most often. And then they bring that down to a sample of 100 times where they run the models to give you a range of the possible scenarios. So 538 is run models for these races. And they have Ron Johnson slightly favored to win over Mandela Barnes based on all the times they've run these models. They have Tony Evers heavily favored to win over Tim Michaels. And then I'll get to the third one in a second here, but that raises this possibility: ticket splitting. Is it possible that both incumbents win, which would be incumbent Democrat Tony Evers and incumbent Republican Ron Johnson, as opposed to both Tony Evers and Mandela Barnes winning, or Tim Michaels and Ron Johnson winning? You know, who splits their tickets come November and goes with either the incumbent choices because they don't have any reason to vote against the incumbents, or votes for the challengers of both parties because they're on an anti-incumbent, you know, tear on their ballots this year. I don't know, Luke. I'm never one that's going to predict a split ticket. That you know, incumbents of different parties are going to win. I guess I tend to be more partisan, thinking it's either going to be a Republican year or it's going to be a Democratic year.
Well, I mean, the state of Wisconsin was only a few thousand votes in 2018 from handily reelecting Senator Tammy Baldwin and reelecting Scott Walker in his bid against Tony Evers. So it was a, I forget the exact numbers of that 2018 race, but it was a thin margin that Walker lost to Evers, and it was those returns didn't come in until even, and this was before absentee ballots were widely used as they were during the pandemic. But that race came down to 1:30 in the morning, I think it took for to get called. And so there's definitely a possibility, but I would feel like if this 538 polling has Evers handedly winning against Michaels, that I tend to agree with you that if Evers is going to have a large margin, Mandela is going to almost use Evers' coattails on that then. Mm-hmm. I would assume it would be the reverse effect of Evers using Tammy Baldwin's coattails 4 years ago.
Well, and it's hard to see given how strongly Tim Michaels performed across rural Wisconsin. It's hard to see if Tony Evers wins handily, you know, how Ron Johnson wins as well, because if Tim Michaels loses after that much of a rural vote, you'd have to think it would be both Evers and Barnes. Meanwhile, in Wisconsin's third congressional district, we've talked a lot about how evenly split that district has been historically, but in the 538 models, it currently says Derek Van Orden would win handily over State Senator Brad Paff, the way things look right now. And that's not the world's biggest surprise in that district. And it's also why in that district, I think you can't call that one yet with a safe prediction, simply because you have these two other marquee races on the ticket for both U.S. Senate and governor. And I would have a tough time seeing Van Orden win if Tony Evers and Mandela Barnes have pretty healthy margins, because what it tells you is not just that they won in the strongholds of Milwaukee and Madison, but that in all of the larger areas, voted, and that includes La Crosse and that includes Eau Claire. And if you look at the primary results from Brad Paff, you know, he won very handily around La Crosse, where he has heavy name ID. He took all of the counties that were, you know, contiguous to La Crosse there, and he's going to get an immense boost by voters in Eau Claire now that he didn't get in the primary, and in Menominee that he didn't get in the primary, and here in Chippewa Falls, you know, where again he didn't get that in the primary, but he will in the general. So I understand the models running saying that Van Orden wins, but I would like to see those, you know, again, they said they ran 40 different simulations. I'd be, you know, what was the metropolitan turnout each time of, you know, Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls and Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, Wausau? What does that have to look like, for Van Orden to win or lose? And then, you know, how does that change what your strategy is? Do you just keep trying to get out the vote in cities or out in the rural areas? These are things people get paid a lot more money than me to try to figure out.
Well, and there's an interesting phenomenon that's going on, and I think there's a lot of studies going into it over the last 2 years or 4 years now since Trump was elected. You see a lot of this Trump blowback at the national level. Like, Democrats were able to take back Congress, the House, the Senate, and Joe Biden won. And there's almost a weird phenomenon, though, that you see the top of the ticket, people are voting for Democrats, but if they're typically like a historical Republican voter, they almost have this down ballot guilt, and they will just go and Republican all the way down ballot. So there is some interesting phenomenons of that could reelect Evers, elect Mandela Barnes, but then see success for Derek Van Orden in a place like Wisconsin's third.
Yeah. And that's where, again, people are going to be really watching for that. I mentioned that Ron Johnson was in Racine County over the weekend, and I just noticed a tweet from Mark Pocan having some fun with it, because Ron Johnson had posted, you know, about a packed stop in Racine County, and Mark Pocan, you know, retweets the photograph and says, "Wow, what a large and diverse crowd of older white people. Did you share with them your ideas of making Medicare and Social Security eligible for annual cuts and stoppage of payments if government shuts down? I'll bet they might not be so excited. If you lose those people, Ron, you've got an empty room." That's what Mark Pocan put up for us. So, you know, it's the gloves are off here. You know, Mark Pocan and Gwen Moore have had no problem going after Ron Johnson and Derek Van Orden. And it's going to be a very animated campaign trying to keep that third congressional district in Democratic hands. We'll wrap up our visit today right after this. You're up north.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
It's Monday morning across Wisconsin, and it's going to be largely nice weather-wise. In the northern and some western parts of the state, there will always be a slight chance of hit-or-miss rain during the week. But for it looks to be maybe the southern two-thirds of the state, it's going to be a dry week overall. The weekend is currently not looking great, looking potentially pretty rainy across Wisconsin. But again, it's Monday. We see those forecast change many a time. Tomorrow, we talk to a couple of different candidates. Dick Ausman is a candidate for Congress in the 7th District, and Bob Look is a candidate for State Senate in the 29th District around the Wausau area. And again, our thanks to Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation area for joining us to talk a bit about the primary election results. And, you know, we've been talking since then, Luke and I, about what has to happen, either from a campaign strategy or messaging side, or, you know, what voters have to see for the elections to go one way or the other come November. And I'm looking at a graph that was copied from Matt Iglesias, who I used to follow when he was with Vox, and now he's got his own column going. And I've kind of fallen off the Matt Iglesias bandwagon. I kind of liked that occasionally he'd have these contrarian points of view, and now they just seem kind of borderline goofy.
Just contrarian for the sake of being contrarian, I think Matt Iglesias is.
Yeah, and it you know, when you do it that way, it doesn't always work. And so he puts up this graph from the Survey Center on American Life, and he labels the graph as, quote, kind of remarkable. Well, here's what he thinks is kind of remarkable. The percentage of men and women between 18 and 29 who identify as liberal. And sometime before 1998, according to this graph, it was roughly about the same. About 27% of men, 28% of women identified as liberal. And the graph shows over the years up until now, this immense divergence that women are now up to, again, ages 18 to 29. Now it's about 43% identify as liberal, whereas men, it has slowly gone down to 25%. So almost a 20-point gap now between women and men, which, you know, we've all seen it. We've seen women become more progressive, more liberal, and we've seen men, you know, become more tribal, you know, and less liberal, especially in the Trump era. And Matt Iglesias, again, listed as kind of remarkable. And one of the responses from a woman was, yeah, from a bunch of people who've never had to change. You know, they life is good for them staying where they are, whereas women have had to become more active and, you know, rethink their political stance. So there's a lot of outreach that has to be done to young men. And I think this repeal of Roe v. Wade certainly helps in that effort, but you still, you know, I mean, I was going to say you see the Trump rallies, but now I'm reminded that Jordan Klepper did that Daily Show piece on the Waukesha rally. You were telling me about that first, Luke.
Yeah, Klepper's Trump rally was pretty interesting. There's just a lot of out there beliefs that you see, like this woman that I don't even remember what it's called, some kind of thing where words or letters equate to numbers.
Oh yeah, the weird coded thing, yeah. And every word means.
Yep, and so there's just some like weird out there, and a lot of apparently the Waukesha Trump supporters that were at the rally a few Fridays back now were obsessed with the Pizzagate stuff, and so it just comes down to that. But it is this kind of. There's like a Joe Rogan kind of mindset for, because I fall in that age demographic. I am in the age demographic that you're talking about right now. And I have friends that I when you talk to them about things, their initial jerk reaction is kind of more of a conservative kind of thought, and maybe more towards that Joe Rogan libertarian thought than necessarily more liberal stuff. But it's interesting as... Before I worked with the radio station, before I began working here, I worked in the nonprofit sphere. So I was working on nonpartisan but progressive-minded causes around the environment, around good governance, stuff like that. And the rise of young women that were... I was in the minority in those nonprofits because there were not a whole lot of guys my age working on those issues and working in that field. And so I can definitely see from... firsthand experience that yes, women are dominating that field right now of progressive activism, and it is an interesting divergence. And Matt Iglesias, he likes to throw things out there sometimes, but this seems to be one of those ones where it needs to be talked about.
Yeah. Well, and you have this again, dating back to your, you know, the Rush Limbaugh era, you know, you have this demonization of, you know, being open to compromise, being open to maybe changing your preconceived notions about people. And now it's insulted as, you know, wokeness, and wokeness is weakness. And, you know, the line you're going to hear all the time on this show is, you know, woke just basically means don't be a jackass, you know, and respect that somebody's, you know, religious background or their gender identities or their sexual choices, or, you know, a father's decision to stay home while the wife goes to work. I mean, these are the elements of a modern world. It's a modern world that is no longer ruled by default by white men. And there's a lot of men that feel, you know, that they are threatened by that. And rather than look for ways to not only embrace, but help other people thrive in this world, they go for the, you know, the easy insults, or at least the easy answers. And that's libertarianism. Libertarianism is the ultimate reach for an easy answer. You know, well, let's just give people, you know, a few more rights and make government a little smaller. You know, again, sounds fine on its face, but decisions eventually have to be made. And those decisions very rarely will benefit the people who have often received the short end of the stick from government. And yet, remember what Angela Lang told us last week, you know, giving somebody else the rights that you already enjoy does not take rights away from you. You know, you're not giving something up except maybe some privilege that you had that you didn't earn, that you simply had by circumstance of where you were born, what gender you were born as, the household income that you were born into. And, you know, I'm not saying all this to be terribly, you know, preachy, you know, to any of you, you know, intentionally, but other than to note, if we can get people to think twice about, wait, why did I think libertarianism was the way to go? Or and maybe improves the caliber of leadership that we have in this country. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is Up North News, and we'll be back tomorrow.